Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us in studio today is Ms. Toko Didiza, who has served as Minister for Public Works of the Republic of South Africa from 2006 through to 2008. Prior to this appointment, she was Minister for Agriculture and Land Affairs from 1999 until 2006 and Deputy Minister of Agriculture from 1994 through to 1999. She was a member of the National Executive Committee and National Working Committee of the African National Congress, and currently she holds the position of House Chairperson in the National Assembly of Parliament in the Republic of South Africa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Amelia, and to your listeners, good morning.
What has kept you going for so many years in the political arena?
I think it's the passion for the work I do. Firstly, I don't regard it as work more than a commitment towards social change in our country, in the continent, but also globally. Also encouragement and knowing that what one represents, it's not just a local struggle for women's emancipation, but it is a global struggle and a continuous one at that, because we have not achieved all what we had set ourselves to.
Yes, it is ongoing, and I had a conversation previously with Mrs. Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi, and she was saying to me that from an activism point of view, we've gone through various phases. In the past, it was liberation, but we will always have a struggle to contend with, and it's just about addressing new issues.
True.
Now, in your new term as House Chairperson, what does that entail?
Actually, let me just first explain that there are three House Chairs. You have got the House Chair for committees. You then have the House Chair for International Affairs. And then you've got the House Chair Internal Arrangements, which is a position that I hold, which really deals with, I would say, is the soft issues in any administration, because I deal with members' interest, which would include the tools of trade for members, what will support them to do their work effectively, but also deals with the issues of members' training. For instance, if there's a new tax law, you'd have to appraise members about what the implications of that are to themselves, but also what are the implications to the various constituencies that they would work with in terms of their committees. There are also issues where they are intersectoral. I would make an example, for instance, with respect to housing development. Housing will have to work together with the Department of Water Affairs and Sanitation for the provision of sanitation. They would have to work with the Department of Local Government to ensure that there is land secure, there is also services provided, so that when a unit, a house, is built, it can actually have all those services. So in terms of budget allocation, Water Affairs and Sanitation will have its budget, Housing will have its budget, so it will have to be communication to ensure that in terms of the timelines that such departments have, you know, indicated that they would want to achieve, they would have taken those into consideration.
There's got to be a coordinating effect of being able to integrate everything together across those different departments.
Precisely. That's why in the executive, maybe if I were to use my past experience having operated there, you've got clusters which brings different ministries together that work largely on the economic sector, on the social sector, crime and justice. That formula allows for collaboration and integration amongst different departments. Also in Parliament, you've got those clusters that operate to ensure that even at a portfolio committee level, there can be some engagement among different portfolio committees, so that in their functioning, they also support the work of the executive effectively.
Thank you for explaining your new role. I think it offers incredible insight into the workings and keeping things in line within the parliamentary situation.
Well, thank you.
Turning to more of the focus on the show, with us being a gender-based program, women constitute 52% of the South African population. They're a significant demographic group in society, and their rights and their needs must be recognized and attended to, and most likely they're best addressed through various government directives. In our 2014 elections, we had approximately 25 million registered voters. Nearly 14 million of them were women. But there still doesn't seem to be a direct approach from various political parties in South Africa to actively target this group. What is your perspective on that?
Well, I must say that that is not just a South African challenge. It is a global challenge. If you look prior to 1994, you had a very important mobilization and an organization thereafter, represented by the Women's National Coalition. And part of the mobilization was precisely the conscious realization that if women collectively cannot work to advance their interests, they may easily be forgotten. Until the women mobilized themselves under the umbrella body of the Women's Coalition in 1992, and asserted their right that, one, starting from the representation in setting out the agenda for the negotiation, as well as drafting the principles to support the Constituent Assembly, that if there are two members of the party, it must be a woman and a man.
So we have a 50-50.
And we were able to achieve that through that mobilization. We had a minimum program as women across political spectrum, across religious sector, across class, to appreciate that if we didn't work together, we're not going to succeed. The second achievement prior to 1994 was that through that mobilization, we're able to insist that the equality clause be embedded in the constitution. But thirdly, was being able to produce the Charter for Effective Equality in South Africa. It was done in two ways. One, it was a focused research, but the other was participatory. We build up a hype, but also consciously asking women to think about themselves, their situation, and what needed to change. I think this gave us a platform around which the issue of women's, you know, emancipation did not just become a side issue, but became integral in terms of the transformation of our country. What happened thereafter? I think we have been able, in my view, to make sure that we don't lose those gains. We've been able to ensure that in the representation across the board, not just in the political spectrum, gradually, one of the issues that I think as a country we've had to grapple with was, do you concretize the instruments for representation, such as quotas? And I think that's where we have not yet, in my view, been very firm. We've been able to assert that at different political parties' level. I know within the ANC we started far off from 30% in 1991 conference. We went on and on until we achieved, you know, to assert it in the constitution of the party for a 50% representation. We won that battle, in part by ensuring that consistently within the party, the issues of women's rights as human rights, you know, has always been at the center of the debate. There are obviously challenges, which in my view are challenges that as women we have to deal with. How do we have confidence among ourselves? Because if you said correctly, more than half voters were women. That would be the same even when you look at different parties.
Yes, because it's a representation of our country.
But the question is, at that level, when women nominate candidates for parliament, do they have confidence in nominating women?
I think that's an important point.
I think for me, that's part of the challenge.
And one of the things that I contend with as well, apart from women representing the majority of voters, in South Africa, we account for 2 million more than our male counterparts. From an education point of view, versus the ratio of tertiary education graduates, mm-hmm. women account for 60% versus men at 40%. So we're more educated, in effect, than men. But yet, there's elements of discrimination that we experience. And when we look at it from a political point of view, if women could just use their electoral power more and to participate, I think, in more democratic forums, whether it is voting on school boards, community forums, and actively participating, it, they'll have a chance to change the landscape of the country.
For me, the other thing, Amelia, is for women to appreciate that entering the political environment, they themselves need to introduce changes rather than accepting the frame that were found that this is how politics works, because I think that's what gets intimidated.
Forming it from as an active stakeholder, participating
precisely
in terms of what she needs for herself.
If you look
and her family.
When we went in Parliament in 1994, for me that was a very interesting period, because here we came in a very masculine environment. I think there was one women's toilet, so we had to actually change the environment to make sure that, you know, this parliament contends with the fact that they are now women. Secondly, in terms of the programming of parliament, ensure that that programming takes into consideration that taking the breaks must be aligned with school holidays, because now we want to spend time with our children. Children, I don't think before factored in any parliamentary programming, because, it was all men, women would look after the kids.
It was the wife that was doing the job.
Exactly. But also, 6 months in Cape Town and 6 months in the administration didn't bother whoever thought about programming of parliament, because they would shift everybody. A lot of their spouses were not working. But we had to actually bring in a new reality that this is a changed environment. You have got mothers who are parliamentarians. Thirdly, issue of productive rights. We had to ensure that this new legislative environment post-1994 contend with the fact that productive rights, even for parliamentarians, can't not be an issue. They are a factor, because a majority of us went in there while we were still at our childbearing age. I remember two of my kids, I got them while I was a parliamentarian, first as a deputy minister and the other when was a minister. And I didn't feel ashamed about it, because being pregnant is not a sickness.
No, it's
it doesn't
part of,
inhibit
part of the course
me to
of
do
life.
The work. And I think that was also an affirmation for a number of women to say, you can do it. I think for me it's about how do we change the political architecture as women such that it does not intimidate us. I mean, I've seen it while I was a minister of agriculture. When I was trying to understand why a lot of women wouldn't want to move beyond the level of deputy director general to a DG position, some of them felt it was too demanding in terms of time. It would have taken more of their time from their families. So I think it's about looking at those things. How do we change them for women? You look at the local government level, for instance. You do have women who are mayors, who are councillors, who are very effective and successful in their work. But a lot of women look at the environment and think, whoa, a bit harsher, you know. Sometimes you have to contend with all these, you know, negative statements from the media, and how do you deal with it? But that also, in my view, requires how do we strengthen the women's movement so that it's not only a few of those who have taken a leap either in politics or in the private sector, but how do you continuously groom a cohort of women who will continue to actually participate in these structures and see them as any environment where women can participate? I mean, one of the slogans that we had from 92 towards 94 was that the woman's place is wherever she wants to be, because wanted to change the psyche.
I like that slogan.
Not just of women, but also of society. But also understanding that it's not for the sake of it. You know, if you've got half of the society not being able to make an impact in how society is governed, how society operates, actually you have undermined your own democratic processes as a country, because half the society's view you don't even know. So for me, it's important that our society appreciates the leadership role, the contributions that women can make in the development of society, but also the different styles. I always say it's very interesting, because when it comes to leadership styles of women in the boardroom, men are quick to say, oh, women are emotional when we are said to be speaking at the top of our voices. But when men bang the table and they are angry in a meeting, that's not seen as emotional. I mean, really.
Yes, it's the same coin, just a different side.
Exactly.
Heads or tails.
And I think we need to be comfortable with that.
We must be. And the reality is that men and women are different, but they bring to the table diversity and complementary benefits. We've got advantages, we've got disadvantages, and it's about working together in a more cohesive manner.
Certainly.
We will be right back after this.
Hi, this is Lyra, South African Afro soul singer and songwriter. You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Ms. Toko Didiza, House Chairperson in the National Assembly of Parliament in the Republic of South Africa. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. Now continuing our discussion. You'd mentioned before about changing the political architecture and to better suit the needs of women as well as men in society. And I think that one of the areas that I'm particularly proud of from a South African point of view is that we have 41% female representation within our government structures. And according to the Interparliamentary Union, we're now ranked 10th in the world. What I also thought was interesting was that other countries in Africa, like Rwanda and Senegal, hold first and sixth positions, respectively. But when we look at so-called first world countries, the likes of America, USA, they're only 85th in the world. The UK is 65th and France 48th. It makes me, and I think any logical person, ask, why is there such low representation of women in first world countries? But for you as a politician and having experienced the transformation that has taken place in South Africa and for a country which consistently pursues equality, what's your point of view on the matter?
To be honest, without in-depth research, I cannot put my finger on it as to why you would find such low representation. Is it because political participation is not seen as of interest? I wouldn't know. Because these are, as you say, established democracies. You wouldn't say that there are any legislation that are inhibiting for women's participation. But the question is it the weakness of the women's movement that has made those countries not to have pressure in focusing on women's issues and in particular, women's representation? I wouldn't know. But what you'd find in our country and in the continent in particular, I think there's a level of consciousness among women that they are an important stakeholder for the development of their societies. So women have actively chose to participate. They've continuously strive for participation, not again for their own sake, but also to improve societies in various aspects.
And do you think that part of that is to do with the liberation struggle, where we had men and women positioned as equals, and they went in as comrades in arms, where there was equal responsibility, that is cascaded across into our democracy from a political perspective?
Yes, but I think it's important also to look at that journey, because for me it's a very insightful journey about women's leadership and women's mobilization. If you look at the African National Congress, my party in particular, you had women, even when the talks about the formation of the ANC was still in its incubation. If you look at the 1912, even pictures, you had women from the churches, professionals who were part of that formation. But women were not given membership of the ANC. But did they sit back? I didn't. People like Charlotte McGregor continued both theoretically in actually articulating the gender struggle within the political frame. When people talk about Maxeke, they talk about this heroine, but don't talk about her contribution scholarly and what she had done. She was also an organizer and a mobilizer. She mobilized women around social issues that were affecting women at the time. They finally formed an organization, a Bantu Women's League, and I think it was at that time that the ANC realized that if they keep these women in the fold, they'll continue being an uncomfortable irritation, I suppose. So better bring them into the fold. But that didn't make women activists in the ANC Women's League in particular conformist. They continued even within the ANC to pursue the struggle for liberation, but also for women's liberation. They never, sat back and say, okay, now we're part of the party and therefore, you know, women's issues are secondary. They continue to work even across political spectrum, across class. The Federation of South African Women in 1956 is another case in point, where the ANC Women's League worked with other women's organizations in pursuit of the liberation struggle, but more importantly, of women's emancipation struggle, even internationally. My own view is that women have been very conscious in the continent about the need for pursuing women's emancipation struggle. You look at, I mean, I always say people celebrate the Organization of African Unity. I do celebrate, it's important. But before the OAU was formed in 1963, in 1962, women formed a continental body, PAWO, the Pan-African Women Organization, older than
women
the OAU.
Always seem to be slightly ahead of the game, whether it's about the charter preceding the Freedom Charter. We had the Women's Charter.
Women's leadership has been very conscious about their role and place in society, but also what they can bring. And looking at issues of society and what they as women can contribute. I look at today, we've got the Women Commissioner in the African Union, the chairperson of the commission, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. Already in looking forward, she's not saying we dump the economic program, which is NEPAD, but she has challenged countries to say, let's think beyond the now and have a long-term vision to say, as we celebrate 50 years of the Organization of African Unity, what do we envision this continent in 50 years? But for me, she could have done that by having few technical committee people and present it to the heads of state. But true to being a woman, she did it in a consultative way. So for the whole year, there were consultations with women, there were consultations with youth, with the arts and culture, with everybody else who feel they have been a part. So that program, in terms of its ownership, is not going to be just a program vision 2063 of the heads of state, but the different constituencies that were party to its formulation will see themselves in that program, and therefore they will work towards its achievement. And for me, that's one of the contributions that women bring in any leadership.
And you've touched on a very important point there concerning women and leadership. I think that leadership is a really important function for the future of women in terms of building their capability and enhancing their contributions to the economy. And we've all seen that we've had significant gains in terms of women's representation within the parliamentary space. But interestingly, the Business Women's Association South Africa conducted a census in 2012 of Johannesburg Stock Exchange mm-hmm. listed companies. And I know that these figures tend to mirror other studies across the world, but they showed that only 21% of managers were women. What do you think we can take as learnings or be able to apply the same principles that have been used in government into the private sector to increase levels of female leadership?
I will take your question even further, maybe in trying to understand what has made the change in the political environment. It is because of women's movement and women activism, which I think is the same spirit, in my view, that we need to take in the private sectors, that women must lead those struggles. Because as we all know, it's about power. Power can never be handed on a platter, nor can it be negotiated. You have to find a way in which you alter the power game. And looking at what you have, numbers as such, and looking at how you could use those numbers into actually changing the environment. Don't expect that somebody, some CEO will come and think, oh yeah.
He's not going to hand it over.
But also one of the things for me, which I think at a political level have been done very well, it's not making the women's emancipation struggle as only a women's issue, but it's bringing in the center of the table so that both men and women must contend with it. But also, you know, it's to help men to appreciate their role in oppressing, but also their role in liberation. How can they be part of the liberation movement? And I think it's important to make sure that in dealing with the gender struggle in our society, we don't leave men, and only take an oppositional stance. but it's how do we also mobilize them and conscientize them about the need for change. The other issue is how do we as women utilize our role as mothers in ensuring that we produce a new breed of young men that would become part of the society. At times, we, on our own, we perpetuate certain stereotypes. When those young people are at the age of, let me say, 6, 7, they can now take their dishes to the sink. What do? We say to the girl, can you please take your brother's plates to the kitchen?
So we're perpetuating certain elements.
So part of those things is the things that we need to relearn as women to undo.
But on that note as well, I think that rethinking on in terms of gender equality, it sometimes touches sensitive points, whether it is culturally, religion, and tradition. Do you think we'll come to a point where we'll be able to overcome those issues for the sake of women's development?
My sense is that we can, and probably we need to unearth and maybe do some work, research, to look at certain changes and shifts that have happened in our society. I mean, I remember growing up, having a woman in pants was like taboo. But where are we today? It's no more an issue. To have a woman who's a traditional authority, a chief, was unheard of. But today we have. And for me, I think the gains that we've won, to ensure that we don't lose those gains, it's how do we able to ensure that we utilize those, you know, instruments and institutions we've put in place to actually advance gender equality in our society.
And legislation is absolutely vital. And if we consider currently we've got the South African Woman Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill, which is undergoing various revisions and consultations. But ultimately, its intention is to be able to position and achieve equality for women across the board, whether that is in the public space or in the private sector. Do you think that legislation like this, it will help close gender gaps?
It will, but for me, it's also about the application thereafter. Most of the time, one of the things I had to contend with when I was a minister, we went through our legislative review, got some gender experts to look at them, which one was not gender sensitive, how do we change it, and so on. You then end up with a very gender neutral legislation, which is good, super. That's all what we need. But how do you make sure that in its application as a legislation, but also your policy instrument and your programs talk to the different needs of both men and women? I would use a very small example with regards to access to finance. So a woman farmer, even a woman professional, you go to the bank with all the equality clause that there is in the Constitution and in the financial legislation, you ask for a loan. The first thing they ask, are you married? You said yes. What's the type of marriage? In community of property. They said, we need your husband. And you sit there and you say, we fought for equality. We have an equality clause. But how does its application in a marriage of in community of property, you know, places itself?
Because the same rule doesn't apply to him when he goes in to make those applications, whether or not he's married in community of property.
Exactly.
He's not asked those same questions, but we confront it, and I've experienced it as well.
So what I'm saying is that at times it's the application of the law. Similarly, I mean, I remember one time when SABC wanted to change its program calling all farmers to some time during the day because they thought it was too early in the morning and they needed to change it. So I said to them, maybe allow us just to do a little bit of discussion with farmers to see whether or not the time at which you wanted to change it would be acceptable. And we wanted to use it as a test case to actually show that at times the gender neutrality may miss in the application of a particular program, policy, or legislation. So we went and had a meeting with these farmers, both male and women. So it was very interesting. The house was split in half. Men were indifferent. They didn't care from whatever time it's changed to what time. And all women equally, they just said no. So we said, what would you prefer the time to be? They said, before news time or a little bit after news time in the evening. It was quite interesting. So we said, reasoning? They said, you know, that's why those men are indifferent to whatever time, because 5 a.m. they're still in bed. I have to make sure that he has his breakfast, he has water. At that time I'm up, the children have to go to school, I have to prepare the kids, their lunch boxes and so on. So I would never have time to sit and listen to radio. During the day, I'm in my fields. Afternoon, I come back, I have to see to the kids coming back from school and start to preparing supper. The only time I can be able to listen to anything will be just before news time when I'm eating my dinner.
And the other dynamic that you've raised there, it sounds as though she was also a filter to her husband or partner within the farming environment, that she was the one that was taking in the news information and relaying it across.
Yes, even though it may not be exactly the same, you would see it when you go to farmers' meetings. One time I actually asked, I said, you know, you guys, if you want to meet with the minister, I see you. I've never seen any woman farmer. If there are agricultural shows, it's largely women, I mean, largely men rather. I said, when do you ever go to the farm? And every time I ask them, where are your wives? Oh, yeah, he's at home. Basically, that woman manages the farm. The man becomes a political activist, you know, to argue with government about this law or that law. So half the time he's not the farm. The person who really runs that farm is the woman who's not even given an accolade of being a farmer. So it is those issues that in the application will emerge. And I think as women's leaders in positions of leadership, those are issues you have to be conscious about. So when you look at this application of law, you need to think in your psyche, how will it land to women? What are those things that I will need to factor in to make sure that women can also benefit from this legislation maximally?
We will be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chakachaka, and I'm UNICEF and Rollback Malaria Goodwill Ambassador. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in the struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy. A program against social ills such as racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Balka every week on this day at this time.
We're talking to Ms. Toko Didiza, House Chairperson in the National Assembly of Parliament in the Republic of South Africa. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. Now, picking up on our discussion, one of the areas that I read in terms of your self-development is that you consciously pursued your academic education in tandem with your political career. And I consider that education is a vital tool to empower individuals, both from a point of view of their self-development, but also in terms of contributing to their societies. And even basic levels of literacy and numeracy have shown profound benefits, particularly from a woman's point of view and her well-being. UNESCO indicated that benefits include greater control over fertility rates, reduced child mortality, improved health management, and poverty reduction, and indicated that an additional year of schooling equated to yielding a 10% increase on her earnings. Do you think that we as a country are doing enough to educate our next generation of women, especially in underprivileged communities?
I think we do. As you said earlier, Amelia, the statistics that we're looking at in terms of tertiary education and the access, both for men and women, and the performance, it indicates that we've got more women, firstly in terms of entry, but also even their performance has actually increased. My sense is that what our government has done, particularly giving more support to basic education, to make sure that you capture a lot of young people into schooling, it's a very important one. But beyond that, given our socioeconomic situation as a country, to actually have support, you know, like having food at school, you know, school nutrition, in my view, has been a very important and an added benefit to ensure that you can have more and more children in school. At a tertiary level, the support in terms of NESFAS. I know there is a complaint that it's not enough, but it has actually gone a long way to ensure that children who come from disadvantaged communities who wouldn't have been able to access tertiary education today, they are able to do it. And what I found interesting is that where a majority of women have actually gone through schooling and tertiary schooling level, they actually would educate their siblings. I'm not saying men don't do it, but in majority you'll find that a lot of women will do that to make sure that a lot of their siblings would actually benefit from their own education to be able to also get through to school. And a majority of women put emphasis into education. I mean, in their budget, they would do everything else, but they would make sure that school needs are the first that are met, you know, in the household.
A priority for her children.
So for me, I think as a country, we have done what we could. We could still do more, you know, to ensure that we encourage more and more people to make sure that they actually take education seriously, not just for themselves alone, but also for the contribution into their society. You raised an important issue about I continued studying even while I was a minister. I mean, part of the reality is that I believe in lifelong learning because things change. If you look at the world today, it wasn't like when I was growing up, but also if you look at technology, technology changes very quickly. And these are the applications you have to utilize in your working environment. So you have to develop yourself. Otherwise, you would be redundant in the work environment. For me, it was also about decision making. I mean, I was a deputy minister in agriculture, which is an economic sector. So how would I have coped if I didn't empower myself in understanding, you know, economics? Informing yourself about the sector in which you have to operate in, expand your knowledge of it. If you are in a decision-making position, it enables you to look at things differently. Because while your professionals within that environment will empower you with knowledge, will give you the necessary recommendation, you must also be able to have an independent mind to reflect on the issues, because you don't only looking at the administrative or the technical issues, but you also have to have the balance in terms of the political issues, not just in your local environment, but globally, and be able to say, what will the impact of this decision be today, not only for South Africa, but also the interlinkages that are there between what we do and what is happening outside. So it became important then, it becomes important even now in the area where I'm in.
We're coming to the end of our show now. In closing the discussion, can you please share a few words of wisdom and inspiration that you would like to pass on to women in Africa that are listening to our show?
What I can say is that South Africa is part of the African continent. The issues that affect South African women are similar to those issues that affect women in our continent in different ways. We talk about issues of violence against women. That remains a challenge across our continent. We speak about issues of equal participation and equal representation. We still have got a long way to go, not just to South Africa, but continentally. So what it actually means for me is that it is necessary that we need to find linkages around which we can continue to engage as women beyond our national borders in ensuring that we can actually build solidarity. And for me, I think that's a strength that we have, not just because of our numbers, but also because women are able to engage and interact. And we need to be able to build networks that would put us in good stead in dealing with some of these challenges. We now have got a continental parliament, the African Union. There's a need for women's parliamentarian within that AU to actually find common objectives around which they can work together as women parliamentarians of the continent to pursue those issues that still continue to affect women.
Thank you for that important message. It's been a pleasure to have you on our show today.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, and we have been talking to Ms. Toko Didiza, House Chairperson in the National Assembly of Parliament in the Republic of South Africa. Tune into the show next week when we speak to Mrs. Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi, Special Envoy on Gender for the African Development Bank.